Hey everyone, my name is Xander Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, and I do interviews for an audience of entrepreneurs. And I'll never forget, I talked to one of the people in my audience, and he had gotten funding from Y Combinator, built the app. The app was getting massive numbers of downloads. I don't remember how many. And I was excited about it. I said, this is fantastic. I thought this could be like someone I should have on Mixergy. This is someone we should be featuring. And he still was a little down. And I thought, what's going on? Why are you so down? Why isn't that number exciting you? And he said, well, what we're realizing is it's not that hard to get downloads. What is hard is to get people to keep coming back to our app, and we can't get them to remember to use our app. And I remember asking, well, why was it so easy to get downloads? And he said, well, if you just get featured a couple of times by Apple, the downloads will come. That's not so hard. It's the retention. That's what we're struggling. We can't get people to remember to come back to download our stuff. And he had an e-commerce app. And so, of course, people think of going to Amazon and other e-commerce apps before they think of going to a newbie. And that's the pain. Today's guest is an entrepreneur who understood that pain long before other app makers and digital brands understood it. He created a company to help solve that problem. And recently they changed their name to Braze. His name is Bill Magnuson. And I invited him here to talk about how he understood this problem, how he built up a company to help app makers and other digital companies solve the problem, and where he is right now with the business. This interview is sponsored by two companies that you probably heard me talk about forever. And the reason you hear me talk about them forever is because it works and people keep signing up and tell me how happy they are. So you're probably going to hear me talk about them more in 2018. Here they are. The first will help you hire your next great developer. It is called TopTal. And the second will help you host your website right. It's called HostGator. Bill, I'll tell you about them later. But first, good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Let's talk about numbers. How many users, people like me who aren't, well, I guess we have an app, but how many users are actually engaged with your software?
We track about 1.3 billion monthly active users across the globe and across about 400 different companies.
And these 1.3 billion users are using not apps that you create, but apps that your clients create. How many clients do you have?
Exactly. So we have about 400 distinct kind of company entities that we work with, and that's spread out across, you know, 600 applications probably, as well as websites and other sorts of digital properties that they use to manage relationships on.
You know, so you've got an enterprise product. When I try to figure out what you charge, all I come across is the same thing that everyone else does, which is demo. Press a button for demo, not press a button to see prices. I'm sure that the prices vary based on clients and based on the work you do, but can you give me a sense of what a company would pay?
And so our average contract value typically for an enterprise client, and we're, of course, primarily working with we're working with consumer brands or consumer scale brands, is in the six figures. And we're working with clients on an annual basis. And, you know, really, you saw it in the numbers. If you just do the quick math of 1.3 billion users across only 400 clients, we're obviously working with people that are generally at scale. And what we want to be doing is really working with them on long-term plans and really driving toward goals around long-term engagement and driving revenue from customers after building up a strong relationship with them. So we want to make sure that, you know, we're invested in our clients and that they're invested in ours. And that's why I think that that enterprise model actually works really well for what we're trying to accomplish with our product.
Give me a sense of revenue. Where are you guys? What do you feel comfortable saying publicly?
So we don't disclose revenue numbers, but we can say that we've increased by double digits. We've had like over 10x growth over the last 3 years, and that's a growth rate that's been continuing to.
We can say over 7 million, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You blew right past. Can we say over 15 million?
I'm not gonna.
You're not gonna keep going escalating, but yeah. Seven was laughably small. I could tell. All right, let's understand how you got here, and then we'll understand the details of how you guys work now that you are here. You're a guy who used to work for Google. You worked on something called App Inventor for Android. This helped universities do what?
So App Inventor for Android was originally targeted at university level education for computer science. It's actually since had two additional lives, which I think are really exciting. One is that it's actually moved into younger and younger classrooms, and the kind of the beginnings of it were targeted at university level. The second one is that it has become a open source foundation for a lot of other applications. And the thing that it does is it's a visual programming language for building mobile applications. And so we started it at Google and Google Research. It was called App Inventor for Android. And it was, you know, it was actually at the very earliest days of Android. So right around Cupcake, if you remember, like the MyTouch 3G coming out and being the hot new phone, that's kind of the era that we were working in. And we piloted it at a bunch of different schools. It was used to remove a lot of the stumbling blocks of dealing with syntax and things like that, and still teach people really great programming concepts and allow them to get up and running and building an app that they can see and touch and use immediately.
And you did something that very few Googlers do, as to my knowledge anyway. You went to work for an investment company, for Bridgewater. You're working there for a little bit, I guess 16 months. And the itch, the entrepreneurial tech startup itch gets you, and you decide to do a TechCrunch event. What was a TechCrunch event and what happened there?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. I was actually a former colleague of mine who's now our CTO, John Hyman. He and I had worked together at Bridgewater, and he had gotten the entrepreneurial bug as well. And so he invited me to attend the TechCrunch Disrupt Hackathon with him. And that was the Disrupt New York Hackathon back in early 2011. And we decided to enter the programming competition together, and it was one of these all-night hackathons where you start at Friday night and you stay up all night and you do all your presentations, you know, disheveled in the morning, having not slept. And the application that we built was called Guilty, and it was a browser plugin that let you arbitrage items that you had gotten from the flash sales while they were sitting in your cart. And that was a really, you know, exciting opportunity for us because we were able to build this cool thing, you know, in the hackathon. I was able to work with someone that I had worked with at Bridgewater in the past. And it really unlocked a lot of potential for us as a pair to have an opportunity to really go start something else on our own.
But the idea was, there's a flash sale, I put the thing in my cart, and then I auction it off to see if anyone wants to buy it for more than I paid for. And if they do, I buy it from Guilt, and then I sell it for higher than I paid for it. If I can't find anyone else, I never even buy it. That's what won.
Exactly. Risk-free arbitrage. And you could imagine the same thing working on anything where you're allowed to kind of hold inventory for free. So imagine going to an open table site and all the reservations are gone, but there are people that were auctioning them off and you could just bid on, you know, a reservation that someone else is holding.
Or tickets to a Live Nation event, et cetera, right? You put it in your basket, you get that countdown that says pay for it. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. That was what it did.
And what you did was you went to the hackathon just to like feel, were you thinking you were going to start a business, what I'm trying to get, or was it just to stretch your creative abilities and see what you can do?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely weren't planning on building a business out of that idea. And in fact, we didn't, right? The company that we started ended up being in a different, obviously a different space. But you really like the excitement of it and the energy around it, the ecosystem that was around it, and also just legitimately love building things. And so, the opportunity to just spend 24 hours coding and working on something was really appealing to both of us.
All right. Meanwhile, once you win, in fact, even if you just show something interesting, people come to you. And so you got a bunch of opportunities. Anything go anywhere?
So we had people coming out of the woodwork from a lot of different dimensions. We actually, you know, Guilt invited us to come in and give a tech talk about what we built. And we kind of talked theoretically about if someone were to do this at some point, you know, how could they detect it and, you know.
Oh, they wanted you to come in and talk about how to stop it.
Yeah, exactly. And you mean you could imagine this not being helpful for a company that's selling restaurant reservations or tickets or whatever to have this presence in their space and have people feel like maybe their carts were getting stolen from them or whatever it is. You definitely see the ill will towards scalpers, and this is almost putting scalpers into Guilt, which they definitely wouldn't have wanted, as well as other opportunities from angel investors and VCs and other entrepreneurs that were looking to start things. And so there was just a lot of opportunity that kind of came out. And as we analyzed all of those, there was this, our co-founding CEO, Mark Ermazian, was down in Houston, Texas, and he had an awesome track record of starting companies, tech companies in the space. And he was kind of on hiatus from that and working in oil, natural gas at the time. But he wanted to get something started up in mobile, and we were very like-minded, and we all decided to come together in New York.
He was in what?
In oil and natural gas.
Okay.
So Mark was, his family owned oil and natural gas holdings. And at the time, he had successfully transitioned out of his prior startup and his executive experience, he just got tapped to go kind of work, you know, work on that family business. And but the whole time he was doing that, he was really interested in the mobile space. And so he had been, you know, working on some side projects and things like that. And so when we spoke to him, I was still at Bridgewater, and, you know, I kind of was considering making my next move. And John and I were looking at opportunities together, and we found someone that, you know, we.
Oh. And you found someone in him. I looked him up, by the way, in preparation for this interview. Tell me if I'm pronouncing his name right. Gurmazian?
Yep, that's right.
The Gurmazian family is, according to Wikipedia, the Gurmazian family is a family of Persian Jewish origins who have developed several of the world's largest shopping malls in addition to oil and gas, as you talked about. And so he independently was doing these other projects. And yep. This guy at Lightspeed, who you guys happen to meet on the walk over to the TechCrunch hackathon, says, hey, I like you guys. I like where you're going. There's a guy you need to meet. He introduces you to Mark. Mark becomes the CEO. What's his contribution to the mix? I know that you guys had clear – or did you guys have clear roles? And if you did, what was yours and what was his?
Yes, we definitely, you know, had clear roles. So I started out as the CTO. John was the CIO, and then Mark was the CEO. And because we had, I always describe this as having the like advantage or the liberty of having two technical co-founders. You know, usually that's something that you've got an idea and you're always trying to find the technical guy, and we had two. And so that was, you know, definitely a big advantage that we had. And as John and I kind of split up the responsibility set, I ended up being a lot more customer facing. So, you know, attending a lot of prospect meetings, client meetings, et cetera. And that really helped us in the early product development, because we were able to take a lot of the insights that, you know, we would get when we were out on the road talking to clients about what they wanted to do, what they were trying to do, and, you know, really looking at it from both a technical and a product perspective.
And bring it back to John and say, John, here's what they're looking for. Can you be more specific about that? Sorry to interrupt, but I want to get a little bit more flesh on that. So you would go, give me an example of a place that you went personally, some conversation that you had that led you and John and Mark to rethink the product, even if a little bit, in a way that you never would have thought before having those meetings. What's one example?
Yeah. So I think that probably the biggest example is that if you go all the way back to the very earliest days of Appboy, and you kind of look back at the old press and our old product positioning, you'll see that Appboy actually, when we first started, we viewed ourselves as something that would be, I call this Appboy as the proper noun, where we would live inside the mobile application and the end user would visit an Appboy logo or, you know, something like that. And they would be able to see their user profile there. That's also where they would see the in-app messaging. It's where they would see the card stream. And these are all things that we still have. We still build user profiles. We still use those to personalize the card stream and to personalize the in-app messaging. But at the time, we kind of viewed it as something that we would bundle together, and it would be in something that was under this kind of umbrella proper noun of Appboy that a user would come to recognize and click on and see this kind of expected user experience. And in conversations with clients, we would get a lot of questions about that. And they would say things like, you know, can I white label this? Can I put my logo on this instead of yours? And on its face, that seems like a reasonable question. But if you think about what they were asking is if they could put a button with their own logo inside their own app. And that doesn't actually make sense. And so when we brought back some of these questions and the feedback and the different desires that people had, where they were like, we love this core feature set. We don't know if we want, you know, all of it bundled together or not bundled together in exactly that same way. We realized that we needed to kind of disassemble it and make it so that it was something where, depending on people's use cases, they could use the different messaging channels that we were providing, and they could, you know, flexibly collect data into the user profile in any way that they wanted. And that was something that I think we would have obviously realized eventually, and a lot of it was due to not just our own learning, but the evolution of the mobile ecosystem that was happening in 2011, 2012. But I think we got there a lot more quickly because we were directly in those client conversations.
How would you get those client conversations? How would you even get in front of someone who would take you seriously enough, considering that you came from Bridgewater? Not, I mean, I guess a Google background helps, but you didn't just come from an environment where this would have been your specialty and people would want to talk to you about what's next. You're coming out of nowhere with this. Why would they talk to you?
I think it goes back to your opener, which is that everyone at the time, they were out getting downloads and installs, and they saw this incredibly leaky bucket. And they were, you know, getting featured in the App Store as a nice free way to get users, but actually more often people were out buying users, and buying users were very expensive. And when you looked at the fact that, you know, 90%+ of them were leaving the application within 30 days, it was pretty clear that these applications, if they were going to run as sustainable businesses, and if they were going to actually build large engaged user bases over time, they needed to have a focus on retention and engagement. And I think that amongst the company set, we were the only people that were working on that. There was so much out there to help you with attribution. There was so much out there to help you with acquisition, you know, to help you with putting ads inside of your application. But actually just like running a sustainable business by engaging users over the long term, that I talk a lot about how, or I used to, there was almost a Maslow's hierarchy, which was that first, you merely existed. Okay, like we've got a mobile app, it's in the App Store, we're good. And then you're like, okay, well, now it needs to do something useful. So we need to go from existing to providing a service. And then once we're providing a useful service, now we need to get a user population. And then once people got their population, then they were like, oh man, I need to do something with these people. I need to engage them, I need to make money from them, et cetera. And so it took a while for the market to evolve to that point. But once it did, we were there with open arms to talk to people and really help work through that.
How did you know about this problem? As you told our producer, most people when you launched weren't even aware this was an issue. How were you and John so aware of it that this was going to be your product?
I think that it was by really learning the lesson that we had seen in the dot-com boom, or that you kind of see in any sort of disruptive platform shift, which is that at first, you know, it kind of goes through that evolution of at first everyone is focused on just trying to figure out what it is and get anything out the door. And if you go back to the web, you know, I went through that exist, provide, and then your numbers, like merely putting your company's phone number in an under construction animated GIF on the web was considered building a company website. You know, if we go back to the dot-com boom, and then we started to figure out like, what are the useful things that you can do with a website and with a web service and with the e-commerce business and all these other things. And then there was a long period where everyone was focused on hits and page views. You probably remember the site visitor counters and everything else. And then the dot-com bubble burst. And the companies that made it out the other side are some of the largest companies that have ever been built in human history. And they're all the ones that were focused on engagement. They were focused on revenue for a user. They were focused on building a long-term relationship with them. And so what we saw in mobile was all the same early stages that we thought, you know, happened during the rise of the internet and dot-coms. And we wanted to be there so that when those businesses matured to that point, that we were ready to help them build sustainable businesses and really take a lot of apps that we saw that had a lot of potential, but they were focused on the vanity metrics and they weren't focused on longevity. And so we just saw that gap because we knew that meaningful businesses were going to be built in mobile, and we wanted to be there to help them when they got there.
That's an interesting approach to finding a product that the world needs. You're saying there's certain things that all businesses need, regardless of platform. Whatever the next new platform is, it probably won't be there first. And we want, someone would need to build it. And so if engagement is one of those issues, I would imagine then if someone came out with virtual reality app platform that actually took off, someone in the audience listening to us, if not you guys, Bill, at Braze, someone would need to say, all these people are going to create apps and it's going to be really tough for them to do it. And apps in virtual reality, let's see if we can make it easier for them to create apps. Then the next issue that they're going to have is how do they get users to come in? And then immediately after that, they're all going to go, holy crap, I got users. I built this app. How do I get them to keep coming back and stick and stay around? And so if any of those pieces aren't in place at the right time, that's an opportunity for a business to come in. And that would be true for wearable technology if apps are existed, for virtual reality, for whatever new platform someone creates. That's the way you're thinking, and that's what brought you to Braze today.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think you also left out chatbots and voice assistants as well. You know, if you go look at all the writings about voice assistants right now, the problem isn't that there's not tens of thousands of different ones. It's an engagement problem. It's the same thing all over again.
Yeah, you know what? I have that exact issue with Alexa. I get these Alexa skills and I forget, what's the Alexa skill that brings up a nightlight? What's the Alexa skill that actually will read a story or have rain go? You're right. There is no repeat business. All right, let me talk about my first sponsor and then we'll come back and I want to find out, now that you had your idea, you got some feedback, what did that first version look like and how did you get actual customers to pay you for it? But first, I've got to tell you and everyone else about a company called TopTal. Do you know TopTal, or am I about to blow your mind?
I don't.
Okay. Good. I think I'm about to blow your mind. Here's the thing. When it comes to developers, when companies are new, it's who can I get? It's like, I got a new company. Is there a friend from high school? Is there a friend from college who's a developer? Is there some event that I can go to and find a developer? And then it's, all right, I got that developer. If it's not there, it's maybe I can go to some cheapo freelance website and find a cheap developer who can take exactly what's in my head, help me structure it in a piece of paper or something or some documentation, get them to program it. That is the first step for any kind of development. As companies progress, they have more funding, they have more maturity, they have more mental awareness. They start to think, not how can I get a developer, not how can I get what's in my head developed, but how can I get someone who's so smart they could outthink me? How can I get someone who's so smart that when I show them what I'm looking for can say, I see the problem you're trying to solve. Believe it or not, there's a better answer out there. That is what companies, and you correct me if I'm wrong, Bill, I don't care if they're a sponsor. If I'm not expressing this right, you let me know. But that's when you want someone who could outthink you. That's why companies like Google spend so much time trying to find the right intelligent person, the way that they think, as opposed to someone who could do a specific task. Am I right about that?
I think so. Absolutely.
How many people are on your team?
How many? We've got, we're pushing about 200 people that will start
the year. 200 at this point? That's even more from when you did the pre-interview not too long ago.
It is. We've been growing really fast.
All right. When you look for developers, and I'm going to get back to the sponsorship message in a moment, what do you look for as a team when you're trying to hire developers?
I mean, I think that you hit the nail on the head that one of the primary things we're looking for is an ability to learn new things and an ability to kind of just apply that intelligence around how do I learn new things? How do I capitalize on them? How do I kind of use them in a way that builds on the past in a really great way? And what we're, you know, I think a big part of our competitive advantage in the space is our ability to consistently be utilizing new technologies with new capabilities and new performance characteristics and things like that. And so I think it's interesting that when you look for experience in engineering, you know, there's one school of thought where maybe you look for someone with X years of experience in some particular platform. If you go back to 2011 and tried to hire an iOS engineer with 5 years of experience in iOS, they obviously did not exist. And what you needed to look for was people that have a healthy track record of really learning and consistently challenging themselves with new generations of technology and keeping themselves current and enjoying that challenge. And that's a big part of what we look for.
I got a friend who recently got a job at Alphabet. It was in the virtual reality, something that I probably shouldn't say publicly. He decided at some point the group that he was a part of was shifting so much that he wanted to go do something else. I said, how are you going to go find something else? He goes, Google will let you just go talk to any other department. And if they want you, you can go work with them. And I wonder, how does someone who's starting with one thing end up where I think he's going to eventually end up, which is the autonomous car Waymo division? How do they do that? And it's because, not that he knows how to build autonomous cars, but he's a smart person who can think through problems and come up with solutions that haven't existed before, and no one can direct him to do. And that's the way that Google thinks. TopTal, all they did was they say, you know what? These types of people are out there in the world. We're going to make a specialty out of coming up with challenges and hunting strategies for luring these people in. And if we get them in our database and we get them in our world, then we can go to businesses and say, do you need a developer? If you do, we will match you with the right developer. You can hire them part-time, full-time, hire a team of people. Sometimes they're a team of people that just love working together and they're top people. You could hire them all at once. That's what TopTal does, and I've hired from them. So many people in my audience and interviewees have hired from them. I'm going to recommend that anyone who's looking to hire a developer, go check out toptal.com/mixergy. No obligation. Once you do that, you're going to see you can't even hire on the website. You can't buy on the website. What you could do, though, is schedule a conversation with what they call a matcher. That matcher will understand your needs. Frankly, also, if you're listening to me, your quirks, like how do you communicate? How do you work? And then they'll go find someone who develops what in languages that you're looking for, can deal with and work with the quirks that you have, because every company operates differently, and then can slide in like a member of your team. If you're happy with that person, you can get on a call with that person. If you're happy with them, you can often start within a day or two. Go check them out. Here's a special URL where Mixergy listeners get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit. I always articulate that extra because I think that when I listen to myself, my New York speed kills the name. Top is on top of your head. Tal is in talent. So Mixergy listeners will get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when they pay for their first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. That special URL is toptal.com/Mixergy. TOPTAL.com/Mixergy. Where are you from?
I'm originally from Minnesota. I'm actually flying back there on Friday morning for Christmas.
You are. Oh, yeah. And this is going to be published right after the holidays. So I'm wondering, when you go back to see your dad, the dad who was what did your dad do? He was an IBM salesman, right?
No, my dad was actually an HVAC maintenance guy.
Oh, an HVAC. Oh, it was. Yeah. So when you go back and see him,
IBM salesman when I was a kid,
yeah. What is he going to make of what you ended up doing with your life? Is this the kind of thing that he thought was the right direction for you or not?
I think that it took him, it took my parents a while to figure out what it was that AppBoy was doing, because, you know, we were operating in the mobile space, and it was a couple years before they even had smartphones, once we were founded. And so I think that they're definitely in a position now where they accurately explained to everyone what I do. And they've absolutely been, you know, really happy and proud that I've loved technology my whole life. And now here we are out building a fantastic technology company.
They didn't freak out when you gave up this great job at Bridgewater. This is a Googler, works with Bridgewater, and now he's going to go start something brand new. They didn't freak out or worry?
And my dad has a healthy skepticism of the hedge fund industry, so I think he was a little bit relieved that I was going to do something else.
Okay. Do you have a healthy skepticism about him?
I mean, I've got my own skepticisms.
Okay. What do you do with your money? Where do you invest it?
I invest in a lot of different things. I like to obviously really take advantage of knowing and being involved in the startup community and give back to that and help be supportive, minor angel investor in cases. And then in other places, I just try to make passive investments to diversify risk and generally let my capital do work.
Yeah, I've not been good at that. I've got friends who are now buying houses here in San Francisco, renting out places in them. I've got friends who are doing like random stuff and it works for them. I've not been good at that. I've been just so focused on my one thing. I'm very myopic that way. Not myopic, very focused.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's better to find something you love and spend your time doing that rather than chasing your capital around. So.
Yeah, meanwhile, though, my capital is not growing as fast as I'd like it to. And I think we should, maybe that's a whole other interview. You look around at the time and you see Foursquare. Apparently Foursquare inspired you and the team. Am I right? Or is that just in my imagination based on how many articles referred to the whole Foursquare gamification?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you go all the way back to our founding and you look at that problem that we were focused on, that Foursquare was a standout amongst a lot of the early mobile apps in the ecosystem because they were focused on the engagement problem primarily. And this whole idea of like gamifying the application, giving people points and badges and things like that. And, you know, I think that a lot of the points and badge systems that people tried out early on were like good early attempts that didn't have longevity in terms of the those specific strategies. But I think that the fundamental idea of like, how do we observe a person through their user journey, recognize important milestones as they're interacting with the brand, reward them along the way, is really just, you know, I think it was a digital and mobile application of a loyalty or rewards program. And to that end, they were one of the best people that implemented that early on.
By the way, when you're touching your desk, I think you've got some paper or something, or it feels like there's paper rustling because the mic is on your desk. So just be aware of that. Okay. So now I get it. It was that you guys wanted an increase engagement for app makers, and you said, here's one way that's working. Let's include that. But it wasn't at all the focus. That's not what you were trying to do. You weren't trying to turn every app into a badge-based Foursquare-type company.
Yeah, I mean, I think that our primary focus was really about how do we improve engagement in applications? How do we improve retention? How do we give people the opportunity to build long-term relationships with the users of their application and turn them into customers? And, you know, one of the things we used to say was like, we want to help you turn your app into a business. We want to help you turn your users into customers. And I think that we saw in Foursquare strategies a really great way of doing that. But that was always just one of the many arrows in the quiver.
Who's the first customer that you got and what'd you do for them?
Going all the way back to our first full enterprise, signed an annual contract, was up and running. Customer was a company called Text Plus. And what Text Plus is their mobile app that their key differentiator amongst all the messaging apps is that they give you a real phone number. And with that real phone number, then you can obviously do a lot of other things. And so it was for people that had phones, you know, whether it was in the developing world or in the developed world or what have you, that had data service, but they didn't necessarily have a phone number, or maybe they needed a US phone number if they were abroad.
And so you got them as a customer. How'd you get them as a customer?
We met them at an event, I believe, early on, you know, just engaging in the technology community amongst a lot of the early app startups. They were actually based in California, and we're based in New York. And so I think we met them at an event in San Francisco, and then we continued to work with them through a lot of the early goals that they had. And I think that, you know, one of the things there is they were giving people a phone number and they had a revenue model, and you could purchase talk time and you could purchase, you know, premium features on your phone number and such. And so they had a really clear model of, you know, what made a user valuable to them. And they also had a subscription based service. And there weren't a lot of those. If you go all the way back to 2012, people that had mobile apps with both kind of multiple products, products that were providing real tangible value, and ones that had subscriptions related to them. And so they were a really great early use case.
And so you knew if you could get people to use their app more, chances are they were going to pay for more minutes or more subscriptions, or I think numbers were being, they charged for numbers at the time, right?
Yeah, I think they had a freemium model on the numbers where you could have it for a certain amount of time. And so also things like reminding people of when things were going to expire were very important.
Okay. And so I could see how you'd offer them a clear benefit. How did you meet them and how were you able to close a sale considering the little experience you guys had? And it sounds like you also had some people who were using the version before you started charging them, right?
Yeah, so we released the very earliest SDK out in just kind of like a public beta to get a bunch of developer feedback and to have people test it out in different integrations. There were a lot of different ways to build apps back then that were popular. And, you know, as you mentioned in the VR case, that as you see new platforms, there's all these different ways of building the applications. And so at the time, even just having an SDK and ensuring that it could go into a lot of different app frameworks and things like that was very important. And so we worked with the developer community that had engaged with us and tried us out through that. And then as we started to build more advanced features, we then started to add, you know, we started to add the pricing to it and really work with people to have to sign longer term contracts.
Oh, so there was a free version. That's the SDK that I kept reading about when I went back to look at older articles. Does that still exist to this day?
No, you got to go all the way back to like 2012.
Okay, so this was when you guys were trying to figure it out. You made this available for free. People got to use it, test it, give you feedback. Was Text Plus one of the free users? Were they one of the experimenters?
Yeah, they started out experimenting, and you know, I think that probably the first handful of full annual enterprise contracts that we had started out with pilots, or they started out by doing a test integration.
Did they find you by themselves, or were you guys finding them and saying, "Hey, we've got this free SDK, go try it out"?
I mean, in a lot of those cases, we were meeting people through the mobile and the startup community. We also have always had extremely good word of mouth spread of our product. And actually, you know, a lot of the people that were at Text Plus were also through their introductions and references to other people that they knew were responsible for a lot of our clients that came in after that.
Oh, who's the person who did this? Was it you hustling and talking to them and saying to different app makers and different companies, is there someone else I should be talking to? Were you that guy?
I mean, when you're a small company, it's kind of all hands on deck to get those first clients in the door. And it was me and Mark were really the primary people.
Largely working your network, talking to friends, when you meet someone, making sure that they introduce you to someone else and constantly following up all the time.
Yep, absolutely.
Someone texts you in the middle of the night, you respond?
Yeah. I mean, it was 24/7 support by a different name, right?
So. Yeah. You know what? I've got friends who are in the early stages of companies and they're the ones who respond the fastest to any text message because they have to.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that, you know, you obviously, as you scale the business out, those things are not sustainable. But you got to do unsustainable things in the early days.
All right. So that's one of the early milestones. Then our producer talked to you about the next big milestone. I was intrigued. You said the next one was discovering what was unique about mobile and digital first companies. What did you discover that made that such a big milestone for the development of your company?
So I think that, that's referencing going back to this evolution, which is that first existing, and then the second step is provide. And I think a big part of provide is really looking at, you know, what are the things about this new platform or this new technology that are going to fundamentally change or provide completely new ways of doing things. And I think a really great example is the entire on-demand economy. So whether it's getting people from point A to point B, or it's delivering food to them, or it's delivering experiences, in all of those cases, you know, that's something that was uniquely enabled by having this always-on data connection with location tracking on it. It also was enabled by having, in some cases, by having a trust network, which is, you know, something like Facebook that would allow you to trust strangers through those networks. So these are like the kind of fundamental building blocks that were required to then conceptualize the entire on-demand economy. And we now see huge companies being built. The majority of them are customers of Braze now. And when we started to see companies like that being built, you know, that I think is distinct from looking at all of the classic enterprise who have products and services that we all, you know and love and have been around for decades, figuring out how to use these new mobile channels. These digital first companies are really an example of like what has fundamentally changed about the technology that allows for brand new businesses to come into being.
Why was that important? Why did you need to identify that the ability to do something like Lyft is important versus the ability for New York Times to have a mobile app? I would imagine that you guys wouldn't care, that it's just about how do we get, regardless of whether it's technology that could have existed before apps or after, how do we get people to use that app more frequently? Why did it matter?
Yeah, no, I mean, you're right that we help both equally. And I think that it just mattered because it was a really great additional opportunity. And it created a lot of these brand new companies so that when we were, you know, you talked a lot about like, how do you get them to trust you? How do you get, you know, how are you the small company that is going into these large applications? And a big part of that was that we were able to work with other companies that were growing up right alongside us in order to get us to scale and get us to that level of credibility early on. And in fact, a lot of the, you know, when you look at a lot of companies in the enterprise, a lot of them looked to companies like Postmates or to Lyft or whomever as great examples of providing fantastic digital experiences, of doing things like, you know, building out growth teams and the way that they approached marketing and product decisions, the iterative nature that they all work through. And so I think that it just represented an important vector for us to be able to grow our own business and continue to push the envelope on a lot of different use cases.
Okay. And then you guys went after bigger and bigger customers. It seemed like in the beginning, it was more the mobile first companies. And then later on, you realized that there was an opening, companies like Microsoft, Citibank, Domino's. Am I right that those became the big success stories?
Yeah, I think that when you look at it today, that really both are vitally important to our business. And we are really building an organization that can provide a fantastic customer experience on both sides of the house. But the ordering was really, yeah, we worked largely with more of the kind of digital first, especially people that were specifically in the mobile ecosystem. But the technology was built to scale to both massive user audiences as well as across all the different, you know, digital properties that someone might have in addition to mobile. And so we had that kind of natural jumping off point. And we've really worked to mature a lot of the processes in the business over the last few years to allow us to work work more fluidly with the classic enterprise, as it's a kind of a totally different ballgame when it comes to things like procurement and security and et cetera. But it's been, I think that as we continue to look into our own future, that both of those customer categories are really important.
All right. I want to understand how you get them and then how you understood what they were looking for. But let me take a moment and talk about my second sponsor and get this. I was at an event recently here in San Francisco. This guy was like 22 years old, fresh out of school, looking for a break from what he'd done before. He wanted to work for a startup. I said, how are you going about doing it? And he said, well, there's this company I wanted. I won't mention their name. I wanted to work for them. So I built a website saying why they should hire me. And he put the company's name in the domain. So imagine if it was Microsoft, it would be why Microsoft should hire Andrew. And he built a whole page, a whole website for them. And he sent it over. And I thought, that's pretty impressive. So you want to work for this company? He said, actually, there are a handful of companies I want to work for. I created a different site for each one of them. And I thought about it and I realized, how much does the domain cost? Domains are like $2, $10 if you go for a .com, right? $2 if you go for some of this cheaper top-level domains. And then he got a hosting package that lets him have unlimited domain hosting, right? He just has to buy the name and then he gets to host it for free. He takes a theme that makes sense, creates a site for it with that theme. It's a few more steps than sending out a customized email, but look at the impact that he has. Think about someone passing it around within the company saying, look at how badly people want to work for us. Look at the kind of person we're attracting. That gets people's attention. And I thought, Maybe that's an approach that companies could take when they're trying to bring in new customers. Imagine, Bill, if I wanted to work for you or I wanted you guys to hire my company. And it would be why Bill should hire Mixergy.com or about why Bill should hire Mixergy.info. And I created a whole site, you know, go the whole parallax effects, whatever it is, that looked nice, that would show you what we do and why you'd want to work with us. That would that get your attention, or am I just fooling myself?
I think it'd get my attention.
Right? Even if it's just like for a second. All right, if you guys are out there and you want to take that approach or any number of other approaches to creating websites, I urge you to sign up for – I'd love for you to sign up for HostGator because I think they're great hosting that just works. But frankly, if you decide to go for someone else, look for this one word – actually two words – unlimited domains. You want them to host unlimited domains because with that, you get to experiment infinitely. Imagine if you just get I could come up with lots of different ideas. HostGator.com, hosting that just works, really inexpensive, and you've got a good group of people behind it. If you go to the special URL, they'll take 50 to 60% off of their already low prices. Frankly, at this point, maybe you can find it cheaper. I used to say I get the cheapest price, but every once in a while, they'll experiment by offering like 70% off or something. At this point, we're talking pennies. Forget about looking for the cheapest beyond this. This is super cheap already, $4.98 a month for the hosting package that includes this unlimited domains. Look at their website for details. And that includes unlimited email addresses, unmetered disk space, unmetered bandwidth, support 24/7, 365, 45-day money-back guarantee. If you listen to me and you think, you know what, this idea didn't work, Andrew's full of it. And if you decide to keep it, $100 AdWords offer to help promote your new business. Here's the URL where you get all of that. And frankly, you get to support Mixergy. Go to HostGator.com/Mixergy. HostGator.com/Mixergy. All right. That was a pretty decent ad read, don't you think?
That was pretty good. I liked it.
I'm always evaluating.
I've got a lot of domains myself. Things. Just random ideas that you have with friends, and I unfortunately am logged into Namecheap on my phone, so I just go.
To this day, you'll go in and on your phone buy another domain.
Yeah.
And I mean, so like, what's one
bucks.
Sorry?
They're only a couple dollars.
Yeah. And so what's one that you've created that you wish you could start, but maybe you could give the idea to the audience because you're not going to do it?
I think this one may have expired last year because we didn't get around to it, but I registered pandaapocalypse.se, and the idea was to use it to just host pictures of large like panda flash mobs where everyone would dress up in giant panda mascot costumes and descend on public parks and other sorts of funny places.
Why? Why would you want to do that? I mean, is it just for fun? Is it something else? What am I missing with that?
I think that's just for fun. Yeah, I don't really see a business idea there.
Okay. I don't have that level of like just fun for the sake of fun thing, but I am with you about like this need to keep creating. You get this stinking app on your phone or you go at your desk and while you're having lunch, you go, this would be a pretty cool site. It doesn't take that much to build. Just go build and see what happens. Unfortunately, it looks like that is available. Someone can go and buy that domain right now.
I would love to see it.
See, here's what I would do with that. I would, if I were trying to get your attention, I would get pandaapocalypse.com, put something on it and say, Bill, your company should work with us. Or Bill, if you want this domain, it's totally yours. Thanks for doing a great interview. But I would use it as a calling card. That's you can buy anything, right, for 10 bucks from Amazon. But most people think if you send them stuff, it's just a waste of space. I don't want it. I hired someone to come to my office and help me just throw out all the junk in the office. Most people don't want stuff, but a domain is kind of a fun thing to get. All right, I got to move on to continue with the story. The bigger companies, I feel like in some ways they're harder to work with. Like Citibank, you can't possibly have a friend of a friend who worked at Citibank, right? You're once you get to the enterprise, how do you get these customers?
I mean, I think that in a lot of cases, what we saw, especially in the very early days, was that a lot of the enterprise clients were hiring people out of the successful digital first companies. So a lot of them saw the successes that were growing in a lot of these new mobile companies. And for them, they wanted to bring to bear all the domain expertise and all of the kind of pre-existing experience that they had with their internal teams and then cross-pollinate that with people that were coming in from other, you know, growth teams or other sorts of teams at a lot of the digital first companies that we were working with. And so that early cross-pollination was, I think, very important for us to have these deep pre-existing customer relationships because people would have been, you know, using AppBoy, now Braze, for multiple years, and then they would find themselves in a new job and they would immediately get in touch.
That's a big one that they would end up there.
Absolutely. Well,
what about this? So I was doing a quick Google search here, and it seems like Microsoft has a mobile engagement SDK also. Am I right about that?
Microsoft has a lot of different products. I wouldn't be surprised.
But beyond that, it does seem like a lot of people are getting into this space now. You started out with people not getting it, and now there are a lot of people in the space. Let's talk about both sides of that. When people didn't understand this before it existed, you have to sell the problem and then the solution. Then you ended up with this new world where suddenly there were job titles that never existed before, like lifecycle. That's a title, lifecycle engagement marketer. That's a title. Absolutely. You got to sell to.
Yep.
And as the space evolves, how do you make sure that you're catching up to that? I know that you told our producer that was a challenge. And then we'll go into what's happened today.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that what we've been doing is we've really been trying to push this point of view about focusing on the customer experience, focusing on delivering cross-channel and personalizing based on listening as closely as you can across a lot of, you know, across all the different touch points that you have. And those things and doing those things at a consumer scale when we started was new, right? So these ideas of like, how do I build a great customer relationship are timeless. It's like you listen to people, you try to understand them, you try to deliver things or like predict what they're going to want and give them these delightful experiences. And that builds a strong relationship over time, which eventually returns value to you. And then when you look at, you know, how are brands executing on those goals and those promises, we've seen a lot of experimentation in terms of team structure and responsibilities and things like that. And we've also seen people that have come from a lot of different spaces. So some people came from the paid ad ecosystem. Other people came out of email marketing. Some people came from, B2B CRM and marketing automation backgrounds. And looking at lifecycle engagement marketing and looking at this kind of cross-channel consumer scale CRM challenge, it's a difficult challenge. And so for us, really, it's been about more than just building technology. It's also been about educating the marketplace and really helping our customers along the way.
Yeah, I can see the content is a big part of your business today. Teaching, how to increase engagement. You'll even like, you have a list of listicles around increasing engagement. When did you guys get good at that?
When did we get good at content marketing?
Yeah. Was that part of the beginning?
Yeah, we've been building content for a long time, but you know, I think that our efforts to really amplify that in a meaningful way really started a few years ago. And that was as we continued to scale the rest of the business as well. We also started scaling a lot of our ability to kind of have a voice as a brand, to be out in the marketplace educating people. In the early days, you know, a lot of the focus was on just getting a product market fit, as it should be. But as we got there and as we started to have more willing ears out in the market that really wanted to learn these things and were ready to focus on them, we met that demand and we've continued to build out, I think, a really fantastic ecosystem of resources, both the content marketing that you're seeing online, but also through the events that we host, through our LTR conference, which stands for long-term relationships, as well as a lot of the things that we do with our clients in the forms of advisory boards and other sorts of client and customer summits.
So you guys are fantastic at this stuff. Like you've got guides for downloading, blog posts that lead to more information. You got the Marketer Academy, etc. What's the council that you have? I didn't know about that.
Yeah, so we work with our clients and on a regular basis in cities all over the globe, we'll pull together people that are using our product day in, day out, the people that are setting the strategy within their organizations about what their goals are going to be for their marketing and their growth teams. And we like to just pull them together both to, you know, allow us to hear from them directly, for us to kind of tell them what we're thinking and vet that out, as well as for all of them to meet and, you know, interact with each other. And I think that we're, you know, I'm very proud to say that we're responsible for forming a lot of relationships across companies where people now can share ideas and cross-pollinate things across different categories and knowing what's working and what's not.
How do you structure those? I get getting a bunch of people together who are your clients, but how do you structure it so that it's useful for them and meaningful for you too?
So we've been experimenting with the structure over time. And I would say that the high level answer to that is that we've tried different things and then we always ask for feedback at the end and we've iterated on it. And it depends a little bit on the specific market and the types of companies that operate in that market. So hosting an event like that in Berlin is different than hosting it in San Francisco, just as an example. And And I think that a big part of it also depends on, you know, how, what, who the people are that are in the room, what the challenges they have are. We try to precede it by helping understand like what people would like to talk about, what they would find valuable. We then also have our own presentations. We also keep a very close connection with, you know, our customers through our customer success managers and through a lot of the engagement that we do on our own. We actually use Braze in our own dashboard in order to engage our own customers. And so, you know, that helps us to keep our finger on the pulse of what's going on around our customer communities. And so when we're going into those, you know, we're not going in blind. We're going in with a lot of experience from having hosted them over the years, as well as with a pre-existing relationship with
them. And the benefit of these councils is that for the members, they get to come in and learn about engagement from other council members, right? All your clients are focused on engagement, so they get to learn from each other. And then you also want to know from them, what are you missing? What's working for you? What do you wish happened? That's the broad strokes of it.
Yeah. And we also like to kind of talk a lot about the future, be like, this is how we see the various spaces and new technologies. Like, this is kind of what our point of view is about the importance of things like chatbots or VR, AR or the connected home or whatever. And this is what we're thinking about building in that space. You know, we want to hear from you about how you're thinking about investing in it. What kind of time horizons are you looking at? Or asking things like, you know, do these are new feature sets that we're thinking about building or moving into? You know, does the expertise exist in your team? Is this part of what you're responsible for? All of these various things where we can really help vet out our product direction.
Got it. Am I right to also understand that they're helping each other, that they're passing on to you and others what's working for them?
100%. Yeah. No, I mean, the first two things you said there were absolutely
spot
on. This
is such a great idea. I don't.
Building community amongst people is really, really valuable and important.
They're in person.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't talk to a lot of companies that have that. That's brilliant. Okay, all right. The other issue that I brought up earlier was one that you talked to our producer about. You said, look, there are a lot of companies coming into the space. A moment ago, it seemed like I found that a product by Microsoft. You weren't surprised that others are in there. What do you do, considering how many people keep coming into this space, to allow yourself to stay ahead?
You know, we just stay focused on what we know best and what we've been working on for over 6 years now. When we really started out, I think that we were the only people that really deeply attacked this problem of lifecycle engagement out of the gate. When you look at a lot of our competitors, you're going to see people that came from, you know, single channel messaging of all different kinds. You see people that came out of the analytics space, people that came from like A/B testing, people that came from the ad space. When you look at how our legacy competitors have kind of assembled themselves over the years by just buying different things and bolting them all together, all of those approaches, you know, I think are kind of iterating toward what we started out with. And so we started out with this stack, this vertically integrated stack that was purposely built for lifecycle engagement. And we've been focused on building a really deep and high quality product experience. And so, you know, as there's definitely been a lot of noise in our marketplace, there's a lot of competitors, and we've just stayed focused on providing an experience that has a lot of feature depth. It's got integrity to it. It's got stability and reliability. And ultimately, it's delivering on what customers are asking of it.
All right. You know what? I should have probably even said this at the beginning of the interview. Braze is the company name. It used to be called AppBoy. One of the reasons why you guys switched was you go beyond apps, right? And you wanted to be clear with people that you allow them to engage in multiple platforms, including email and social, et cetera, right?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, apps were obviously an important part of our, you know, early years. But as we look into the future and as we look at this problem of engaging customers, it's one that is not tied to a particular device or a particular medium. And we've always delivered messages across channels. We've always pulled together user profiles by pulling in data across all the different touch points that a customer has. And so we really, you know, we like that Braze is about bringing people together. It's a verb that means to bond with great strength. And the new name is really focused on what we're trying to do for our customers and not just a, you know, kind of particular point in time in technology.
So we used to all be excited about how how Foursquare would let someone be the mayor of the coffee shop if they checked into the coffee shop a lot and encourage more people to check in and so on. Today, what is something that is exciting to you that if someone's listening to us, they'll say, wow, Braze is actually really doing something amazing. I wish we had that. Let's close it out with that use case. Then I'll thank everyone and we'll send them over to your site, braze.com. So what's a good example of that?
Yeah, so the things that I get really excited about are places where people are using real-time access to data and things that are kind of changing in real time. So I guess two great examples. One is an application that will that allows for people to transfer money to the friends and loved ones in other countries and such. And they're going to be particularly sensitive in a lot of cases to fluctuating exchange rates. And so the ability to kind of deliver these notifications to people as exchange rates hit certain thresholds allow for them to transfer that money back to friends and family and do it in a way that they're comfortable with. And that's a great example where you've got this like real-time data-driven experience that's really driving engagement, and it's delivering it via a messaging channel in a way that is a marketing goal but really adds to the product experience. Another great one is for on-demand ride sharing or on-demand food delivery, preempting bad weather. So the on-demand ride sharing example I think is really good. If it's about to rain in your area 30 minutes from now, that means that in 30 minutes you're probably going to be in a case where you're trying to get a ride home and you're switching back and forth between multiple ride-sharing apps trying to see which one has, a lower multiplier. Whereas if I can preempt that and I can tell you that, in 30 minutes it's going to rain, you should order a car home right now, you're going to have a better product experience because you're not going to be paying any sort of surcharge. And I'm also going to capture you as the customer because you're going to service directly. And so that's another great example where, you need to be able to know where the user is. You need to be able to talk to them. You need to be able to have access and this ability to act in real time. And so those are, I think, both really great examples that are really leveraging, the edge of our technology.
And that's utility. It's usefulness. It's not gimmicks. All right. The website is Braze. Actually, it's just Braze.com, right? It blows my mind that you guys didn't even have to get Braze Analytics or something. It's just Braze.com.
Braze.eu.
Braze.eu too. Because of the data protection.
Absolutely.
I see.
You need to have an entirely isolated EU stack to help with data privacy concerns.
Got it. All right. Braze is the name of the company. Thank you so much for being here. And I want to also thank my two sponsors. The first is the company that's going to let you become a website or domain addict if you want to. It's called hostgator.com/Mixergy. And the second one will let you hire your next great developer. It's called toptal.com/Mixergy. And of course, as always, guys, we're trying to get feedback on the audio quality and the way that we're doing these interviews. Let the team know. It doesn't even, you could say nasty things about the way that I'm presenting myself. It doesn't have to go to me. It could just go straight to the team. We want to improve. I don't want to call anyone out. If you're unhappy, I want to hear about it without making you feel bad about telling me. Here's the email address, contact@mixergy.com. Super simple. And of course, you could always reach me at that email. Just let them know to pass it on to me. Cool. Thanks, Bill.
Yep. Sounds good.
Congrats. Bye. Bye, everyone.